you know, that's one of the reasons why I, too, like Quichotte, am at bottom an optimist. You know, and what I did with the character of Quichotte was to take my often unjustified optimism that simply won't go away and exaggerate it, make it crazy optimism. And so he, in a way, is an exaggeration of me. And you know, you were asking about Larry David. I mean, Larry David said to me about the character that he plays that it's an enormous exaggeration of himself, that he is a bit like that, but the character is a zillion times more like that. And I think Quichotte is like that in the relationship to me. I think he's me enormously magnified.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is Quichotte. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. For comments about this program, write bookwaves@hotmail.com. And for more information, go to bookwaves.com. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
Andy Whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on now, whoa, 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 whoa. Andy Whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all. Whoa, 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 whoa.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Horowitz. She's a printmaker, drawer, and book artist, and her show Blue is on now at the Froelich Gallery in Old Town through May 29th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful.
This show is pretty minimal. You go in and these are big pieces of paper attached to the Froelich walls by little magnets, just kind of dangling there. And you get a great sense straight away that someone's has put a lot of effort into choice of paper, choice of medium, you know, whether it's ink or print. So go in the gallery, turn to the left, and on the big wall by the window, there's a big piece called Blue Seed Heads. Is that right?
That's correct.
Blue Seed Heads. And it's that plant you see everywhere in like junkyards. It's sort of skinny with lots of things coming off the top and little flowers or seeds at the top.
Exactly.
What is that in Latin?
Well, actually, there's a lot of versions of that plant. They're in the parsley family, a lot of the carrot family, like the Queen Anne's lace that you see around. Mm-hmm. In this case, I actually used the dill from my garden because it grew about chest high. Mm-hmm. And so I dried it and saved it in my studio, anticipating wanting to draw it.
Oh, okay.
But they're all related, similar families. Here we have a wild version called a Lomation.
So what did you do? You took this plant in the studio. You don't take a photo of it. You have it right in front of you.
Yeah.
And then you've got this beautiful paper, this Okawara paper, right? Handmade Japanese paper. And then how do you get this image onto the paper?
Well, the paper is pretty important. I get all my paper, most of my paper, from Hiromi International, which imports Japanese and Thai and other Asian papers. Most are made with kozo fibers, like a mulberry fiber, also gompi or Mitsumata fibers, which are the three primary fibers they use for paper making. And so I'm starting with the plant, but also the paper, and how the two are going to work together in terms of composition and in terms of just how it feels to me. So you're right, I do bring the plants into my studio. on occasion with my work, I work outside, but most of these are all done in the studio. And in this case, I had to dry the seed heads. I had them hanging upside down in the studio since I cut them in the fall. And then I first have to prepare the paper. It's very, very soft paper. So if you just tried to draw on it, it would be like trying to draw on a napkin. And it would just absorb the ink and it would blob all over the place. So I have to seal the paper and I use what we call sizing. In this case, it can be any kind of glue, but I use gelatin. Literally the Knox flavorless gelatin you get at the grocery store. Because it's easy to dilute with water. I used to use special Japanese sizings, but I got the same result. And then I can mix pigments and colors into that sizing. I can dye the paper. I can use stains. And it stabilizes the paper. It also makes it very crispy, sort of a hard surface. And that enables me to draw on it because all my drawings are done with a nib pen. So a small metal attachment to a pen holder that's then dipped in ink.
So you get the paper, you sort of stain it blue with yeah. the sizing, and it makes it a bit wrinkly.
Yeah.
Let it dry, and then it's all ready for your ink pen.
It does get very wrinkly. I have to press it for a few days to get it flat, and then it's ready for my ink pen. And it's just not a very predictable process. So I sometimes get blobs or different tones, sort of cloudy looking textures happening in the background. And at first, when I started doing this process, I thought that was a problem, but it turns out to just create more interest and more for me to respond to on the paper surface.
So if you're drawing a stem and something happens, a blob of ink, what do you do?
Well, if it's a blob, you just leave it, and the less you touch it, the better. That actually shows, I feel like it shows the hand of the artist. It shows the mistakes. It shows the inconsistencies, and those are actually quite interesting to me. So little blobs, little specks, the less I touch them, the better. Otherwise, they look like you tried to cover up a mistake, and that always looks worse. But if it's like a line that goes the wrong direction or something, I basically have to work with it. Mm-hmm. I have to figure out how to adjust my composition and how to adapt to where the drawing is going and how it works in the space on the paper.
Do you work upwards? So these plants, they're a long stem that branches out, and then at the end you've got this kind of like firework, this explosion of new little stems going upwards.
Actually, that's funny. I hadn't thought about that, but I actually work downwards. Oh. I start with the explosions. It depends. I sometimes work upwards too, but I generally start near the top with this explosion of seeds and then bring the lines down because that helps me figure out spacing and composition and to place them. And then depending on the density of lines and of the stems, I'll start adding more stems in, sometimes from the bottom up.
And then this work, I mean, you're kind of, it's imaginative, right? You're not copying the plants, you're doing a composition, you're adding bits where you want them based on an original plant. But so you're building up this composition of this sort of branching series of lines. When do you know you're done?
That's a good question. I'm slowly building it up. It's just an intuition thing. It's slowly adding. They go fairly quickly, but not fast enough that I'm just going to shoot past that point of being done. And it's a balancing act. I keep adding in certain elements, and it's all about the lines and marks on the paper. So in a way, it is representational, but it's also very formal about just this ink on the surface, density of line, that kind of thing. And if I think I'm getting close to done, I sometimes will just walk away and wait and then come back to it the next day. I don't think there's a real way to know other than to stop when it seems like it's getting almost there and take a break, walk away.
And if you really don't like it, when you feel like you messed it up, you prepared to just recycle the paper?
Yeah, absolutely. In some cases, I can save part of it for another drawing or a bit of something else and literally cut off those sections. There's a piece in the Cascade AIDS Project auction right now that the paper was amazing. I did a drawing. It was terrible, but I kept it for years. And then I ended up just covering the entire back with black sumi ink and drawing on the other side. So it sort of obliterated the drawing. So it either gets covered up, it gets cut up, or I just move on. You know, it is expensive, but considering that I don't go through 10 before I'm done, I might mess up on one where I really don't like it and I put aside and just say, no, that one didn't work. Mm-hmm. So considering the amount of time I put in and then what the artwork is worth to me and also monetarily, $25 for a piece of paper isn't all that much.
You also draw pines, being very northwesty. The pines have a different structure, and because the stems, the main stems are broader, you have a lot more room in there to, you know, show the play of light off the stem to make it a bit more realistic.
I think that's what originally drew me in and got me started on these drawings was the pines. I'm using the same small nib pen, but in this case, I used white sumi ink. I've tried all kinds of white inks, and the white sumi ink tends to have the most opacity and the highest pigment content. And whatever binder they use in the fluid, it's got a really good flow that works well and sits on top of the paper beautifully. So it was drawing these pine needles and playing with the gesture and the movement of the needles and the branches that really drew me in. I can get a fair range of different kinds of marks and thicknesses with these nib pens because they're flexible. So that's what gets me the sort of wider marks and also the very tiny thin marks. It's just the same pen. But the pines definitely drew me in. And where I live, there's ponderosa pines. Ponderosa forests are our main native tree. And so it's kind of how it feels either in the morning or evening, especially when there's a lot of snow on the ground.
So yeah, I think you were just talking about dark blue pines too.
Yeah.
So you have white on dark blue pines, okay, and you have blue on white. Tell us about the difference between those two processes.
Well, the white on dark blue is where I've put probably not just one layer of sizing and pigment, but I've probably put anywhere from 2 to 4 layers of sizing and pigment. And I'm literally using ultramarine blue pigment, bone black, sometimes some Prussian blue in there. And part of the reason for that is if I use something like indigo dye, it's not light fast. And so using pigments that are light fast and physical and permanent makes sure that it's not fugitive. They actually make it a tiny bit gritty on the surface. So as I build up these layers of blue pigment, it gets darker and darker, and it actually gets almost a little bit sandpapery. But that denseness of color and of the sizing allows the white ink to sit beautifully on top. If I'm working in reverse, I think the blue branches and seed heads are the dark blue on the light paper and then also the woodcuts. But if I'm working in reverse on a light paper with a dark blue ink, then I'm not using any pigment in my background in the sizing. So I'm just using clear gelatin because the paper is so beautiful. I love the natural color, the fibers. And so sometimes I just want to preserve that. I put a bunch of layers of sizing on it, and then I'm able to draw on it with a dark ink.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Sarah Horowitz. Her show Blue is on now at Frolic Gallery through May 29th. So I'm looking at this stuff and I'm thinking, why do I want to look at a bunch of plants, you know? Very minimal. What's going on here? Does the person who makes these works want me to feel something completely different? And I figure that the best thing would be just to ask you, when you're making them, because I think they're very process-driven, that it's a long process making them, mm-hmm. you must be feeling certain things that work their way into the art. And you're not just thinking about, you know, the Latin names of plants or the, right. the way seeds do their thing. So right. just tell us what you're feeling as you're doing this work.
You're right. It's not just a botanical study. For me, it's a very meditative process. In my work, I don't take all my feelings and throw them at the paper. It's a process of trying to see the positive and negative spaces, seeing the marks and lines. It's a lot about structure. And so it's not about the plant being a plant and its processes, but it's about the structure of these lines, the way the pine, for example, with the pines, how these lines intersect and form these interesting spaces between them, and then the densities of them, and how the imperfections, the asymmetries, and all of these parts of the plants create a balance. So working with plants gives me something that's inconsistent and not man-made, to try and find a kind of a world in this paper. And it is very two-dimensional, as you can tell. I don't have a lot of depth. It's not deep landscape. But for me, it's a very quiet process of slowly building up to create space and time and sort of a moment on the paper.
When you say something's meditative, I always think that you're sort of trying to reduce the amount of feeling. You know, I think meditation is sort of about minimizing feeling and thought. In this case, though, where you live, right, you live in Leavenworth, which is right. the alpine region of the mountains east of Seattle.
Right.
And it's a kind of German tourist town surrounded by dramatic scenery. It's kind of, your family is Swiss. You live like a romantic poet in like 1780 in this sort of alpine, amazing landscape where people can walk and lose themselves and rhapsodize about nature. So right. which of those two things are you? Are you meditative, head down, trying not to feel anything? Or are you like Wordsworth and Coleridge walking through the Alps?
If only I could aspire to be that big. But I think it's not head down, just turning inwards. It's taking the amazing beauty that I see and trying to interpret that. So what I find fascinating with plants is just their intricate structures, their grace, their imperfections, how they create a sense of place somewhere. So I do live in this alpine town, and it wouldn't be the same without a certain habitat of native plants. And that's what creates the smell and the air and the entire feeling of the place. So all that is absorbed into what then comes out on the paper for me.
So if you walk from your home 10 miles, what are the notable plants you'll see apart from ponderosa?
10 miles gets you really high around here in terms of elevation. Well, our main trees that you'll find are ponderosa pines with an understory of vine maples. There's a lot of shrubs of serviceberry and ocean spray, mock orange, which has gorgeous blooms, and also a lot of Doug fir trees. Higher up, you get some mountain hemlocks. And then right now, it's spring, obviously, and so everything is starting to bloom, and the ground is covered with balsam root flowers. You can see this about 1 mile from my house. So,
what color are they?
They're like little sunflowers on the ground. They're brilliant yellow, and everything turns yellow. And then you've got lupins coming in, which are the purple pea-related flowers. A local rose called a Nootka rose. But literally everything is carpeted in flowers at this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Do you work in color?
A little bit. So inspired by this area, I actually did an artist book a few years back based on the flowers, and it was called Wildflowers, and it was much more oriented towards a specimen book than my drawings are in terms of interest in actual specimens. And it was based on the flowers in the spring, native flowers to this area, and included an essay by a local Washington poet about why this area is geographically very special, going all the way back to the Ice Ages. So that was an examination of this place that I live and why it inspires me. And that was etchings with hand coloring. So I do at times work in color when it feels appropriate to the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you do that for a book, these are one-off books. They're not printed. Is that right? You're painting the colors onto the paper once?
Actually, I had to do it 40 times because I did print it. They were etchings. So it's not just one, but it's a very small edition of 40. So I print 40 of each of the etchings. The text is printed by letterpress. So yeah, we're going way back in time here. And then I hand color, in this case, all the books were fully hand colored. So I did hand color all, I think there were 23 etchings roughly, each 40 times.
Mm-hmm. Where did those books end up?
Most of my books end up in public and private collections, specifically libraries, university libraries. Most of them have rare book collections or special collections. And most people think those are old books, but they actually have huge artist book collections. Our Multnomah County Library has an amazing special collections.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Jim has shown me around in the past.
He can give you a fantastic tour. I've spent a lot of time in that room.
How do you tap into that? That's a world of owners, you know, who are consistent. Their money doesn't run out.
Hopefully, most of the time, although collections do come and go. But it's a process, even though it's a very small niche, it's not unlike other forms of art where you basically have to find the right fit. So researching special collections and what they collect, and sometimes it's local artists, so that's an easier one. But natural history, plants, mm-hmm. The rare book room at Multnomah County Library has fly fish, an amazing fly fishing collection, roses, not surprisingly, books on Native Americans, and sometimes it's things like first editions or just rare books, rare copies of books. But it's also local artists. So I might place a book in a library at the University of Alberta in Canada because they focus on plants, moths, natural history, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So therefore, my book would be a good fit and they would have interest in buying it.
Mm-hmm. Is that done through your gallery, Frolic, or someone else?
Less so. I do it myself and also work with a book dealer out of Maine, Ken Schur. Mm-hmm. And that's his primary business. So he has relationships with librarians and curators and knows what their fields of interest are.
I went to the Multnomah County Library yesterday, actually, and you wouldn't recognize it. You go up the stairs and mm-hmm. there's a sort of a plexiglass screen with a speaker in it. And then wow. People are behind. You don't even get in the door anymore.
Wow.
And I was just picking up a library card, but, you know, it just seems like, oh, God, you know, how are we all reacting to this being cut off from everything?
Right.
When I saw your title, Blue, I started thinking, oh, my God, she's been listening to Joni Mitchell, getting depressed, spent the whole winter in a dark part of the countryside. Is there anything metaphorical about the work you produced this last year?
That's an interesting question. I actually did listen to Joni Mitchell's song, Blue, because my daughter has been taking voice lessons and actually gotten interested in interesting vocal artists. But in terms of my work, for me, the color blue taps into an emotional well that doesn't have to be negative or sad or depressed. It seems to have a really big range. So it can function as a quiet place as well as a really bright place or a refuge or something sad. But it also has a huge value range. So you can go to almost black and to very, very light. And so actually it can function as like a black and white, the way black and white do in terms of values. So I can get the full range of value tones using blue. But particularly it appeals to my sense of colors in nature, shadows, dyes like indigo and other colors that have been used culturally throughout centuries. So a little bit of reflection on the pandemic in terms of, I think it's affected me mostly in terms of the parts that are not my making process. So showing artwork, traveling to go to book fairs, PR, it's all virtual like this, mm-hmm. rather than actually having a big show, kind of having an opening and doing yeah. things in person.
But you are coming back to Portland from Leavenworth April 29th through May 1st, right? You're going to be available in the gallery?
I will be available.
Talk about your work.
Absolutely. I'm going to make myself available for as much of that time as possible. And the gallery can allow a certain number of people in at a time. And so they'll be making appointments. And I'm excited to actually talk to people in person about my work.
What's Leavenworth like? Is it hopping this time of year with tourists?
It's hopping most of the time. The pandemic didn't put a big damper on that. So living here, you actually avoid the center of town most of the time. But we are very fortunate to have so much nature around. So Nordic cross-country skiing all winter and lots of walks and biking and climbing the rest of the time of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You used to do what you do in Portland when you lived here, and you walk down the street, go yes. to OPP, picking flowers and weeds. If you moved back here, would your view of nature be different?
I think so. My view of nature now is a lot more focused around what's native and what creates a sense of place, whereas in Portland, it was just about what was interesting and what had an interesting structure and what was available to me. But people planted everything, and I didn't, 5 minutes from my studio, I didn't have the Cascade Mountains. So here it's more about a sense of place than about just what's around.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Sarah Horowitz. She's a printmaker, a drawer, and a book artist based in Leavenworth, Washington, but will be visiting Portland April 29th to May 1st. And her show is called Blue, and it's on now at the Froelich Gallery through May 29th. Thank you so much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Sarah.
It's been a pleasure talking with you.
This is Art Focus, the show where we talk to artists and curators about visual art, and it's coming to you on your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. My name's Joseph Gallivan, and I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We know times are tough, so if you're not able to donate, don't worry, but if you can, please show your support for this free community resource.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Estás escuchando KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 20 de abril del 2021.